Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with a special author interview with Jessica Kim, the author of Stand Up Yumi Chung, a middle grade novel about a young Korean American girl who dreams of becoming a stand up comedian against the wishes of her immigrant parents, that just came out this past week. Rira and I both read the book, and I'd say we're fans, right, Rira?
Yeah, we're definitely fans. Actually, it's been a very long time since we've had an author interview where we've both read the book. Usually it's one or the other. So I'm really glad that both of us were able to finish the book and talk to Jessica.
Yeah, she joins us all the way from her home in San Diego. Again, Rira and I are both recording remotely in the midst of the COVID-19 outbreak. So through the magic of internet, we're able to bring you this interview. But before we get to that, Rira, remind us what we're reading for the month of March.
We are reading The Map of Salt and Stars by Zane Jukadar.
I've just started the book. I've read the first chapter, so not very deep in yet, but looking forward to discussing that with you in a couple of weeks.
In a couple of weeks, yeah.
But yeah, we had a really great chat with Jessica. We talked to her about her journey as an author, about her book, and Rira even gets to share a couple of her favorite Korean dad jokes. I didn't know she had it in her, but...
What can I say? I love puns.
So please enjoy our interview with author Jessica Kim. And we are here with Jessica Kim, the author of Stand Up Yumi Chung, a middle grade novel that just came out this past week. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing? This is supposed to be your launch week. I know you're supposed to go on book tour this week or throughout the month, and a lot of stuff's been getting canceled. How's that been going for you?
You know, it's a little bit of a bummer. Obviously, you know, we always dream of this day from the very beginning, and I didn't have the imagination to dream that it would ever happen during a global pandemic. And so, you know, life happens and you got to react with it. So while I would have loved to be on tour and meeting booksellers and kids, you know, it is what it is, and we're going to make the most of it. So I'm just happy that the book is out there. And if you want it, you can still order it. And so I've been getting actually a good number of bored kids emailing me since it came out yesterday. So
yeah. I saw the activity sheets that you posted your social media. And I think that is a very, very clever way to get kids engaged, especially parents, because like with parents, they're having struggles with homeschooling their kids, and it gives them a break. So I thought it was really creative.
And
you're also giving away book plates, yeah, right? Like signed book plates.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a former teacher and I'm an Asian mom. So, you know, if ever there is an opportunity to make homework, I will find it. And so it was kind of fun to be able to create some activities. You know, it's like using a muscle that I haven't used in a long time, my teacher muscle. So, you know, I thought it'd be kind of cool because I know a lot of parents like me, our kids just found out Friday, day of, that they're going to be home for a month with absolutely no instruction. And, you know, for for some parents, no training. And so I thought if there's anything I could do to help, that's one thing I could do. So it's been pretty well received. So I'm really happy about it. And I really love the idea that, you know, they can write in and receive something for their efforts.
Well, you're doing everyone a service, because I feel like this is the first time a lot of parents and their kids have been in such close proximity, not on vacation.
Oh, yeah. Like
forever.
Oh, yeah.
There's only so much TikTok can do, you know?
Well, a lot of my friends are young parents, too. So, like, they have, like, little ones. So there's only so many times you can watch Frozen 2.
Right. Oh, yeah. Luckily, my kids are a little older, so we're out of that range. But we've been watching lots of Marvel.
So this is your debut novel, and getting published is definitely a very long journey. Can you just tell us about how you started writing? Like, were you always interested in it, or was it something that came later in your life?
You know, I wasn't even that kid that really wrote a lot, to tell you the truth. I guess, you know, in high school, I did do some journalism, you know, and I don't think I really wrote or read much in college outside of the required reading. So this was kind of a later in life thing. Let's see. It wasn't until I started a personal blog. I had just moved to New York City with my then 17-month-old baby and my husband, who was working 100-hour weeks. And so it was really kind of boring and lonely, and I didn't have a car, and I was just, you know, kind of in this new season of life. And so because I was so homesick, I started this blog, and it was like just a mommy blog, nothing special, but I just really enjoyed it. I was like updating near daily. People were wondering, are you okay, Jess? The readership kind of grew beyond my friends and family, and people started encouraging me to like, oh, you should write a book. You should write a book. And so that was kind of the first time it ever entered my brain that I could even be an author. So, you know, as Asian Americans, it's not really something you see much of. Do you guys know any authors in your circles?
Yeah, we do know a couple in our circle, but I think that's because we live in Los Angeles.
Right.
and people wear a lot of hats. Yeah, I could totally understand the whole like, oh, it's not, writing isn't something that Asian American families really push their kids to excel at, because I majored in writing. So I totally get that.
So I'm kind of a lone creative black sheep in my family. Let's see, my husband's a doctor, my sister's a doctor, my sister-in-law's a doctor, my brother-in-law's a doctor. Like, we have so many MDs in our family. And so the creative thing was kind of just something I did on the side, because I was a teacher for a long time, like I said earlier. So it wasn't until we moved back to California, my husband started working, my kids were in school, and I kind of had to have a little crisis, like a little identity crisis of like, I'm not ready to go back to work, but like, what is something that I've always wanted to do? And like, I decided to finally pursue it. So I literally Googled like how to write a book. So from the very beginning. So yeah, I joined the Society for Book, the SCBWI. I started going to critique groups. I started taking some writing classes here at our local university, and started kind of making friends in the community. And years later, after a lot of work, I was able to sell my first book. Yay!
Congratulations. Yay. And it's something that we see a lot in especially in the world of authors, is a lot of authors, this is like their second career. You know, we've had Henry Lien on, who wrote the Peace Brought Chen series, and he used to be a lawyer.
Right.
A lot of best-selling authors, like, they didn't start writing till like their 40s mm-hmm. or later. Mm-hmm. So writing is something that anyone can do at any time, but like taking it seriously, I think that's the key to, you know, getting to where you're at. What was it like, you know, finishing the book and like the process of getting it to auction?
Yeah, so this is actually my second full-length manuscript that I've written. I wrote another, my first one was actually a young adult novel, which will never, ever, ever see the light of day.
you never know. I know that Marie Lu, she just published a book, and that was like one of the first manuscripts that she worked on. So never say never.
Well, actually, it's kind of like the mother dough of like what created Yumi. So I really want to write about the second generation experience. I really wanted to write about what it's like to be born and raised here in America, but have immigrant parents. So if you go in bookstores, libraries, you'll find some Asian-ish books, but they're usually written from like that first generation perspective. So there wasn't a whole lot about just like normal kids like me who, you know, share this bicultural identity. And so I really wanted to explore those themes, specifically the theme of kind of wanting to be creative, wanting to go a different path than what your parents wanted for you, especially because I was grappling with those same feelings myself. Of course, not from my parents at this point in my life, but really kind of that upbringing that's planted so deep inside that, oh, you shouldn't do that, it's too risky, oh, there's, you know, such a small percentage that you'll actually make it, you know, like those kind of things were so deeply part of my psyche. I was really kind of like fighting with myself, like, oh, but I really want to try it, or oh, but oh, you know. And I, as you know, it's like a years long process where you're kind of toiling and querying and writing where you don't really see much but rejection. And so that's really tough if you've been raised in an Asian American like household. Like, where are the results? You know, like, why haven't you written more? Why aren't you published? You know, like those things can be very difficult to overcome. So it was like this inner dialogue that I was having with myself. And in its first iteration, it was about a teenage girl wanting to be a chef, to go into culinary school instead of college. And so I wrote it. Yeah, right? So I have this fascination with Asian American, specifically Asian American women being where they're not really supposed to be. And so I love that idea of these forbidden places. So I wrote that novel and I queried it, and it, you know, it didn't go anywhere. And I was really devastated. It's so unlike anything I've ever done, in that you could work really hard, but it doesn't really necessarily pay off. Like, there's so much, you know, that has to do with the market demands or what agents are looking for, XYZ. And it wasn't like studying for, you know, the GMAT or something where you know, it's not that kind of venture. So I actually almost gave up, or I did give up. I didn't write for like about a month and a half. And I said, okay, I'm done with this. Like, I'm going to go like pursue something achievable. I'm going to like go do CrossFit or something. Like, I'm going to like do something where I put in the effort and something happens. But, you know, I really missed it. I really loved writing. And so I was walking around Dolores Park with my husband in San Francisco, and we were on a trip, and I just couldn't stop talking about this novel that, you know, like, you know, I was getting some feedback that it was sounding a little young, which at the time I was just so offended by. But then once I got over like the sting, I started kind of listening to that feedback, like, oh, does it sound young? Maybe I'll write middle grade. And then it kind of turned into, well, middle graders don't really work in the kitchen. That won't work. What would be like the Asian mom's worst nightmare? And I was like, oh my gosh, a comedian. Because at the time, Ali Wong is blowing up. And, you know, and so it was on my mind. And I started kind of researching that. And then I discovered comedy camps were a thing. Who knew? And so that kind of, like, quickly tumbled into an idea. It quickly tumbled into a manuscript. The first one, it took me about a year and a half to write my YA. This one wrote itself in honestly about like 6 or 7 months. I took a month to revise, and it was out, sent it out to query right after that. So it was a very different experience writing middle grade and YA. So perhaps my internal age is actually 11 and not 16.
Well, I knew that this book was for me as soon as I read the first chapter. There were just so many elements in the first chapter where I was like, oh my God, this seems so familiar. And for those of you who have not read the book opens up with Yumi at a Korean hair salon, and she wants to get a pixie cut. But her mother says, no, you're going to look like a boy. So we're going to get the same perm that you always get every month, or every summer. And And then there's like her mom bragging about her children with another mom bragging about her sons. And I'm like, oh my God, this is just like this is a scene from my childhood. I can smell the magic straight solution.
The digital pama, the setting pama.
And it mentions BTS, and I was like, oh man, Jessica Kim is like after my heart. And
gotta put in BTS. Gotta put in the Bangtan.
Who's your bias, by the way?
Oh, so since I am like Nuna Nation, I'm a little old to be like their like heartthrob. So I really love RM because I think he's a writer at heart.
I knew that your bias would be RM. I there's a lot of Korean authors on Twitter, uh-huh, and a lot of them seem to be geared towards RM because he's like so intellectual and he's like a really good writer.
When he talks about his creative process, I completely identify with him. And he talks about, you know, his first draft, what didn't make it, I wish I could have added this. That's like my heart. So I have a connection with him, but he doesn't know it yet. So
I was really happy that I was able to identify with Yumi, like even though I'm like definitely not 11 years old, right. But there were a lot of things that I really found relatable. Yumi goes to a private school, mm-hmm, and because her family is blue collar, they run a restaurant. They pressure her to do well academically. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I feel like a lot of Asian American kids now and a generation before us, they do grapple with that.
Yeah.
And definitely with like the SSATs, like I actually took that. And like my parents wanted me to go to a very, very white private school. And unfortunately, I'm not as smart as Yumi, so I did not get in. One thing that I really loved about your book was the fact that even though Yumi's parents are pushing her to succeed academically, they aren't tiger parents.
No,
they seem to show their love and affection in different ways. And I just wanted to ask, like, how you fleshed out that relationship. How did you build have this relationship be something that's not stereotypical?
Yeah, that was actually probably the hardest part because I really wanted to get it right. But in my initial first draft, I was so obsessed with breaking stereotypes that I actually just like wrote the opposite of what people would expect. So in Western media, Asian women are always portrayed as kind of cold, tiger mom-ish, you know, unfeeling. And so in the first iteration, Mrs. Chung is like extremely gregarious and very loving and whatever. And I was like trying to break that stereotype. But when I read it, I was like, you know what? She doesn't sound like any mom that I know. Like, that doesn't feel authentic to me. Like, she had no accent, you know, and just was like hilarious and in a very Western way. And I was like, you know, that's not it. That's not it. So in my rewrite, I actually wrote the character Mrs. Chung the most out of all the other characters. And for her, I realized it's not about breaking stereotypes because that's still letting the Western perception kind of force your hand at like the way things are represented. I just needed to show her as I know her, you know? And so in the first few pages, you might get a very strong tiger mom feel because she is kind of talking a lot about academics and, you know, she may come off as a little bit like someone you might have seen before, but I really worked hard to kind of show different dimensions of who she is throughout the book. So by the end, I hope that readers will be rooting for Mrs. Chung and being able to see her tenderness and her sacrifice and her own version of how she loves her daughter. And I thought that was the most important part for me because growing up, especially here in America, and seeing, you know, love portrayed in that very Western way with the kisses and the hugs and the I love yous. And you look at your own parents, you're like, what is wrong with them? Like, why can't my parents just be normal? My parents don't understand me. Like, they don't know me, you know, and that's very much like how Yumi feels in the very beginning. But I think through her journey, she kind of comes to understand her parents a little bit more. And I think she becomes a little more bilingual and bicultural in the way that she accepts and understands the depth of her family's love and the fierce affection that they have for her. And so I think it is kind of a journey of self-acceptance, of understanding that there are many ways to show love, and it doesn't always look like the way it does on TV. And that was kind of like where I was going with their relationship.
One of my favorite scenes in the book, and it like I almost cried reading the scene. And I'm sure a lot of readers will agree. It's a scene where Yumi sees her father smoking in the alley behind the restaurant after a really, really rough night. And it's like such a great scene because Yumi is able to have this heart to heart with her father, and they're able to open up and communicate. And she finds out that her father also had a dream and he had to defer it so that his children would be able to accomplish greater things.
Yes.
It was definitely a powerful scene for me.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Was it difficult writing that scene? It seems like something that you would have to rewrite over and over again to get right.
That one was pretty much as it was in its initial drafts. And I'll tell you, this is I do hear a lot of people ask me about that particular scene, and I think it's because it comes from a very, very intimate and deep place within myself. I lost my father to cancer when he was 36 years old. So I was 7 years old at the time. And so I don't have very many memories of him. So even writing a father in the novel was a little bit tricky for me, but I do have a memory. He used to own like a kage, like a little produce store. And when he was stressed, he would go outside and smoke a cigarette, because he wasn't a big smoker. It was like when you smelled the cigarette, you knew he was kind of having heavier thoughts. And even as a young child, I remember kind of sensory, you know, like just smelling that smell and that feeling. And so I was so glad I could incorporate that memory into this book. And the other influence is my father-in-law. He is a commercial painter, worked a blue-collar job his whole life, from Korea, came with $20 in his pocket, you know the story, right? And made a life for his kids. And I think it wasn't actually until I completed my first manuscript. I never told my in-laws that I was writing. Like, it was just my little secret. I didn't want them to know. I don't know why I didn't want them to know. I guess I just...
Oh, I can think of a couple of reasons why you didn't want them to know.
I didn't want them asking me about it, and why is it taking so... You know, I just didn't tell them. So it wasn't until I finished my YA manuscript and I was sending it out that I finally told them I was, you know, writing. And I was so surprised. They're fairly traditional. So I was so surprised that he was so like moved and proud. It wasn't until then that I realized, oh my gosh, I think in another life, my father-in-law would have been a writer too, because we had this like connection, you know. And I started thinking back to all the cards he'd ever written me, all the photos he'd ever captioned, and all the poems that he writes like on his spare time for his alumni webpage. And it's like, oh my goodness, he's a writer at heart. And he just never had the opportunity to go there. And that was really very much played a part in my writing of Mr. Chung and his deferred dreams as well. So, yeah, we don't really think of our parents as people who have like had to forego things. We just think of them as providers, especially when we're 11, right? And I think that's like that critical moment where you see them as human beings breaking down, crying, having a tough time, second guessing themselves. And, you know, these are all things that Yumi sees for the very first time. So it's it's a gripping scene, but I think they're able to kind of see each other, you know, hear each other for the first time. So yes, thank you for mentioning that.
Oh, no problem.
Another important dimension to the story is Yumi's relationship with her older sister. And we talked about, Rira and I are both older siblings, so we don't really have the experience of what it's like to have someone have to, you know, catch up to our prodiginess.
Yes.
Well, my cousins are like close to genius level IQ. So like, I think I sort of have an idea of having to live up to that level of like genius, but
Yeah, no, my sister, I actually have an older sister. She's only a year older than me, though, so she's not 10 years older than me, but sometimes she thinks she is, but she is a doctor. She's an MD, and you know the way Asian parents brag. They'll brag a lot about the braggable kid, so it's like, oh, this one's a doctor, and oh, Jessica's really nice, too. Yeah, you know, so there's definitely, like, a skipping over that happens, and I very much wanted to write about it, so that's Yumi. Poor Yumi.
Yeah, what I really liked about Yumi and Yuri's sisterhood was that even though Yuri is someone who is part of Mensa and went to college at a very young age, I really liked her growth as someone who, you know, really wants to figure out who she is and follow her dreams. And this is something that Yumi is trying to do. She's trying to figure out who she is and try to bridge that gap between being a daughter of immigrants and trying to find her place in the world. And I really, really like that. Was that also something that you thought about when you first started writing? Did you give Yumi a sister, like, right from the beginning?
Yes, Yumi always had a sister, an older sister. So if you kind of notice Yumi's life, I very much intentionally kind of gave her two sets of everything. So she kind of has an American set and a Korean set. So she has her parents on one side, they're Korean immigrants. And then she has, like, her third parent, Yuri or Yuri, and she is kind of her American parent. So she has Ginny on one side. Ginny's her Korean friend. And then she has Felipe and Sienna on the other side, her American friends. So she has, you know, Jasmine Jasper is her American comedy teacher, but her Mrs. Park is the Korean side. So I wanted to kind of have those two sides give her strength and value in their own ways and kind of feed into this bicultural experience that she has as a Korean American. And so I really needed Yumi to have, like, a Korean parent. So that's where Yuri steps in. And, you know, then I could talk a little bit about the values that immigrants have and how they're not necessarily born out of materialism and bragging rights, but it's also a security thing, too. And that's something that you maybe can't realize when you're 11 years old and you just want to do comedy and your parent, you don't understand why your parents aren't supporting you. It's because they've lived here in this country and they know, you know, that the odds of that happening are very slim. And so it's an interesting discussion. I don't think anyone's right or wrong, but I think it's a more fuller discussion when you have both sides of your life, your identity putting input into your life, you know. So that was a really fun way. I didn't know Yuri was going to drop out of medical school until I got to that scene. I was like, oh, shoot, she's going to quit.
Is
that a spoiler? Is that a spoiler warning?
Oh, sorry.
I don't really think so. It happens pretty early in the book, and you kind of get a feeling that she will, because, of course, like, you know, like, a lot of like high achieving Asians, they do, like, kind of break their immigrant parents' heart.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's like you live up to so many expectations and, like, at some point that's, you know, that's not your dream. And, you know, you have to, like, figure out what you're going to do for yourself. It's a very, very common thing that a lot of, Asian Americans go through on a daily basis.
Well, that's something that your book does really well, which is really clearly display the tension of how immigrant kids have to figure out how to live for mm-hmm. themselves, because they've lived so long for their parents mm-hmm. and their dreams. And I know that's something that a lot of kids deal with their parents, but it's especially like heightened for immigrant kids, because, like, literally your parents did put their dreams on hold mm-hmm. for you. And so how do you pay that back? And what does that look like? You know, it might not look like what they wanted it to look like, but you being able to pursue your dreams is proof that they were able
to. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't know about you guys, but people in my peer group, a lot of Korean American, Asian American kids did go to law school, did go to med school, did get their MBAs. And now a lot of, like, maybe half are, like, super unhappy. And a lot of people, including myself, like, branched out and did something that we've always wanted to do now that we've kind of bought the house, have the kids, and, you know, have a little bit of, you know, did the immigrant kid part, are kind of feeling a little bit like, well, what would my life look like if I got to do what I really want to do, you know? And so, I don't know. It's a very interesting conversation. It's a very specific kind of burden that children of immigrants carry of like feeling this indebtedness, like this burden to make it all worth it, you know? And so...
And Yumi feels it like even a little, even stronger because she sees her family's restaurant in like financial strain.
Yes.
And a lot of like Korean immigrant families, they run restaurants, they run dry cleaners, mm-hmm. and it is a struggle every single day. And I don't really see that a lot in middle grade and YA novels in general. Uh-huh. Because like I feel like with a lot of children's literature, people kind of want to shelter their kids and kind of keep things light, but kids notice a lot more than people realize. And
Yeah.
And I think Yumi feels that pressure to not let her parents down because of that pressure of like their financial situation. So one of the things that I really liked about the book was the motto, "The only failure is not trying."
Oh yeah,
that is a mantra that shows up repeatedly in the book, and it's actually originally given by Mrs. Park, the Hagwon teacher, mm-hmm. who's telling Yumi that she is second guessing herself on test results, mm-hmm. and I think the whole like the only failure is not trying is something that. I don't know about you guys, but that is not a mantra that I grew up with.
Not at all.
With my parents.
Excellence only.
It is my parents, like it was the complete opposite. Right. Their mantra was, if you're going to fail, don't even try.
Right.
Or
totally.
Don't try unless you aim to be the best. Right. And so why do you think this message of the only failure is not trying is so important to young readers who are going to be reading your books?
I think just where I am in my life, I think as I was grappling with whether or not to write seriously or not, I was thinking to myself, oh, it looks like if I had gone by the you know, immigrant motto, I wouldn't have ever tried because the odds of making it are so slim. However, there's something inside me that always knew I would regret it if I didn't at least try, you know? And I think it's that fear of failure. And this is not immigrant child specific. This is like everybody understands, you know, fear of failure. And I think especially now, you know, I'm a mom raising kids in this generation, this idea of perfectionism and doing everything just right is maybe even worse than it was when we were younger, just because of social media. And, you know, the kind of things they're up against in this economy is just totally different. And so I feel like kids are even more timid to kind of be their true, authentic selves, to try something different, to go outside and make up your own ideas. I think it's a very it's a very timely message and also something that means a lot to me. I still tell myself all the time, you know, that it's okay if I don't get it right the first time. Let's keep trying, get back up, you know, and go out there and try it, I think is the truly the message I want kids to come away with when they finish reading my book, because I think it's one that so many of us need to hear all the time, right? So, yeah, I love that it came from Mrs. Park, the most Korean.
Oh, my God, yes. Did you go to Hagwons growing up?
You know, I worked at one.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. When I was a young teacher and I had to make money for the summer or whatever, I used to work at a Hagwon. But it wasn't Mrs. It was actually, her name was originally Mrs. Park, because the actual Hagwon Ajumma that I used to work for was Mrs. Park, but because I needed to make it Pack Attack, she became Park. But anyway, she was just as scary as I described her. We were all so scared of her, even the teachers. But she was like 5 feet tall. She had like these little glasses. But I think I'm a little bit more Americanized, and so I remember the first time I walked into her office, I called her by her first name, and everyone just stared at me. It was horrible. Yeah, I was so embarrassed. Thereafter, I only called her Mrs. Park. But anyway, that was my funny story.
So like what I found really impressive was that you were able to come up with all of these comedic materials and they sounded like an 11-year-old, you know, wasn't like, I mean, obviously you're not going to have an 11-year-old come up with raunchy jokes, that like Ali Wong and like other Asian American comics do in their stand-up.
Yeah.
So like, can you tell us about how you came up with the jokes?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I have an entire notebook full of like a graveyard of jokes that didn't make it into the book. And so it was not done on the first try, trust me. It was actually probably one of the hardest things about writing a book about comedy was as a non-comedian coming up with jokes. But I do think I benefited greatly from, 10 years in the classroom with a bunch of, you know, preteen kids and what they think is funny, you know, is like very, natural to me. So, you know, I have a 10-year-old daughter, so I know the kind of things that they think are funny, but, definitely took a lot of tinkering, a lot of rough drafts and, throwing out a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm so glad that they were funny to you in the end. I guess that's all that matters. Yeah.
I do have some Korean dad jokes on the side, I think that you would really like them. Marvin's gonna be so lost because he doesn't know Korean.
Okay,
I'm ready.
You're ready? Okay.
I'm ready for
it. Here, Rira.
All right. What do you call a news reporter who interviews the sun?
The sun, like the other?
No, like sun, S-U-N.
Oh,
sun.
Okay, in the sky? What?
Yeah, in the sky. A Harry Potter.
I love it.
And then I'll do one more. What country has four arms?
Oh, I've never heard this one. I don't know which one.
Nepal.
That's good. That's a good one.
All right. Yeah, that was Rira's like two Korean jokes. Yay, that's it. Well, I mean, I am not a comedian.
Well, I mean, Jessica laughed, so it must have been funny.
I did. They were funny to me. You know, people have been asking me if I've ever done stand-up or I've ever done improv, and the truth is I've never done it because I'm too scared. But I will, because I wrote a whole book about not being scared. So one day I hope to do it. Did you guys know there's an Asian comedy troupe in LA? Have you guys ever gone to see Asian AF?
Yeah, we're actually friends with the creator.
Oh, awesome. So,
yeah. He's actually, like, we have a podcast called the K-Drama Podcast, part of our Potluck collective, and he's one of the hosts for it.
Oh, so, no kidding. I have to check it out. Oh, yeah. I'm dying to go. I would love to just watch a few times.
Yeah, once this whole pandemic thing dies down, we'll probably start up shows again. So I mean, you're pretty close. You're in San Diego, right?
Yeah,
so,
not far. Yeah,
it's not too far. Before we head out, I did want to ask, just because we mentioned about that first chapter and the perm story, what was your worst haircut?
Worst haircut. I mean, we all rocked the bowl haircut, did we not?
I actually did it.
Yeah. Was it only cool in the 80s? I don't know.
There are people who definitely have it now. So
yeah, I had the they called it Meimeito, which is like little sister hair, which is kind of that unisex kind of.
Oh my god!
Kind of like a, how do you describe it?
Is it?
Crazy? It's not really a bob, but it's like a bob type of haircut.
What age were you when this haircut happened?
Probably like three or four.
Oh, I love it. I do have a really bad perm picture on my website. So I think I was in the sixth grade. I had like the Yumi perm. So that was, I have so many to choose from. It's hard to just choose one. What about you, Rira? What's your worst haircut?
I was very, very lucky because my mom had pity on me. not so much anymore, but growing up, I had very, very straight hair.
Oh.
So, I just pretty much stuck with my natural hair. And I think I got my first perm in like late middle school. I really wanted one for some reason. I think I was really bored of having straight hair. And it wasn't like an ajumma pama, but it was like, I didn't know how to curl my hair, so I got a digital perm.
Oh, nice.
And it gave me like really soft, soft curls. So
oh, that's
my mom did her research. She didn't want me to look like an ajumma, so I'm really grateful for that. Also, she was very like open about hair colors because I think in high school I had like scarlet, like dark scarlet hair at one point.
Oh wow, you were
cool. And like when I moved out here, I did like the typical thing of streaking your hair. Uh-huh. Like I had like red. I had like one red streak, and I was wondering like if my mom was gonna hate it. But I went to go visit her, and she was like, "Oh, I like your hair. Like you should do rainbow colors."
Oh,
so
nice.
She's very, very open about it. I don't know if it's because she's seen like K-pop on television and she's just gotten really used to it. But yeah, I don't really have a bad haircut story. Oh, sorry, fans.
You got out easy.
Yeah,
I did. only in that part though. I went to Hagwon since I was like 6 years old, so I did not get away with.
Did you have a scary?
That was the only thing. Did I have a scary Hagwon teacher? Yeah. A lot of them were very scary.
Oh, okay.
I had one teacher who they were kind of draconian. They used like a ruler to smack our palms if we actually no it wasn't it wasn't if you got an answer wrong, but if like if other people in your class like if they got it wrong, they were the only ones who didn't get hit. Everybody else would get hit.
Oh wow. My goodness, like psychological warfare. Oh my goodness.
Of course I'm kind of a snitch, so I told my parents, and they're like, "You're not going back there." So they took me to another Hagwon where there were white teachers.
Oh,
so they were much more lenient. Yeah, I have a lot of Hagwon stories. We definitely don't have time to go into them, but man,
you
I have
need
some,
to write a
like,
book. This is hilarious.
I have some war flashbacks, y'all. It's bad.
I love it.
Well, Riri, do you have anything else? Or?
Yeah, I have one last question. And it's, so a lot of people are cooped up because of coronavirus, and a lot of writers, you know, they're kind of stuck in their house, and writing is probably the only thing they can do in this situation. And it's really hard to keep up motivation. So I just wanted to ask like what your, like writing tips are during a pandemic? Like,
oh, to tell you the truth, I haven't written since the pandemic. I'm like not very helpful here. But I am reading, which I think is also a form of writing. So I'm definitely doing a lot of reading with my kids, which is really nice. So I just think at this time, we just need to be kind to ourselves. And if we don't write, I think that's okay too. I just think we need to just focus on being healthy and connecting with those we love. And that's kind of my first priority right now. So don't worry. If you're writing to escape, I think that's fun too. But if you're not into it right now, neither am I. So we're in it together. I think everything's shutting down now anyway. So there's no big time crunch or anything. So take it easy.
Yeah. Curl up with a book. Might I suggest Stand Up Yumi Chung by Jessica Kim?
Whoop, whoop. Yeah, available everywhere.
What's next for you in terms of promoting the book? Are you doing a lot of online things and interviews?
I believe a lot of things will be transitioned online once everyone figures out what's going on. Yeah, I was supposed to do a bunch of things, but it looks like I know for sure LA Times Festival of Books is postponed to October. So I'm slated to be there on a panel. And got a few things webinar wise that I will post to my Twitter and Instagram. So I'm at Jess Kim Writes on both platforms. So yeah, stay tuned. Everything's kind of in flux right now, but we hope to get, you know, at least online very soon.
Well, thanks again, Jessica, for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
Thanks.
All right.
And that was Jessica Kim, again, the author of Stand Up Yumi Chung, available now at booksellers everywhere. And that'll also do it for this episode of Books and Boba. That was a fun conversation.
Yeah, it was. It was It was very lively and very needed, considering that we are trapped in our houses and social interaction seemed to be very, like, very rare. So I'm really glad that we were all able to talk and have a good time.
Yeah, and I'm glad we were able to bring some social interaction to all of your houses today. It's going to get tough out there. We're just waiting right now for the call to lock down LA, but we're going to keep reading and we're going to be talking about books, and please join us. If there has ever been a good time to just sit down and read a book, it is now.
All right. Yeah. Well, we will see you at the end of this month when we talk about The Map of Salt and Stars.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
But we're still here and we're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history. We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turns gallery institution Giant Robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app.